It's Tuesday, March 7. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Victor Beatty. President Donald Trump's administration unveils its revised temporary travel ban after the first one was blocked by an appeals court.
The executive order signed by the president earlier today, protecting the nation from foreign terrorist entry into the United States, is a vital measure for strengthening our national security.
That's Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. We'll hear more from him. Lee Gelernt of the American Civil Liberties Union said the changes don't go far enough.
The new executive order eliminates certain individuals, lawful permanent residents, Iraqis who were part of the first order, but it does not eliminate the central constitutional problem.
And we'll get congressional reaction, take a look at social media, the North Korean missile threat, and the deployment of more U.S. troops to Syria. It's all on today's International Edition. President Trump Monday signed a revised executive order continuing a temporary 90-day ban on the issuance of new visas for citizens from six majority Muslim nations, Syria, Iran, Libya, Somalia, Yemen, and Sudan. It takes effect March 16th, does not include Iraq. It includes a temporary halt to refugee admissions for 120 days. It revokes the January 27 order that had been blocked by the courts. Secretary of State Tillerson said the new order represents another effort by the president to use his rightful authority to protect the American people from terrorist threats.
To our allies and partners around the world, please understand, this order is part of our ongoing efforts to eliminate vulnerabilities that radical Islamist terrorists can and will exploit for destructive ends. The State Department will coordinate with other federal agencies and implement these temporary restrictions in an orderly manner. Our embassies and consulates around the world will play an important role in making sure that our nation is as secure as it can be. And the State Department will implement the provisions in this order that allow for the admissions of refugees when it is determined they do not pose a risk to the security or welfare of the United States. Upon the President's initial executive order issued on January the 27th, the State Department's consular affairs and diplomatic security offices immediately undertook a review in coordination with the Department of Homeland Security to identify additional measures that would strengthen our vetting of those seeking entry to the United States from seven named countries. These early efforts were concentrated on Iraq. Iraq is an important ally in the fight to defeat ISIS, with their brave soldiers fighting in close coordination with America's men and women in uniform. This intense review over the past month identified multiple security measures that the State Department and the government of Iraq will be implementing to achieve our shared objective of preventing those with criminal or terroristic intent from reaching the United States.
Attorney General Jeff Sessions discussed the national security basis of the latest order and the Justice Department's role in implementing it.
As President Trump noted in his address to Congress, the majority of people convicted in our courts for terrorism-related offenses since 9/11 came here from abroad. We also know that many people seeking to support or commit terrorist acts will try to enter through our refugee program. In fact, today more than 300 people, according to the FBI, who came here as refugees are under FBI investigation today for potential terrorism-related activities. Like every nation, the United States has a right to control who enters our country and to keep out those who would do us harm. This executive order seeks to protect the American people as well as lawful immigrants by putting in place an enhanced screening and vetting process for visitors from six countries. Three of these nations are state sponsors of terrorism. The other three have served as safe havens for terrorist countries, countries where governments have lost control of their territory to terrorist groups like ISIL or Al-Qaeda and its affiliates. This increases the risk that people are admitted here from these countries may belong to terrorist groups or may have been radicalized by them. We cannot compromise our nation's security by allowing visitors entry when their own governments are unable or unwilling to provide the information we need to vet them responsibly.
That's Attorney General Jeff Sessions. The previous order sparked chaos at airports and street protests and lawsuits. Some groups insist the new order still remains problematic. Lee Glarant is with the American Civil Liberties Union.
The main problem we have with the second executive order is we believe it's based on religious discrimination. The president's statements leading up to the first executive order, his statements afterward, and the language of the first executive order all reveal that what is essentially going on is a ban against Muslims. The fact that they've tweaked the order does not eliminate that taint. The courts have made clear you must look outside of the four corners of a document at context, at statements. That's what we're going to do. That's what the courts have said they're going to do. And we feel like once they do that, it'll be clear that this is a Muslim ban, as the president made clear himself before the first executive order was issued.
He said the ACLU plans to amend its existing lawsuits to challenge the new executive order in court. VOA's Michael Bowman now has congressional reaction to the president's latest order.
The chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Republican Bob Corker, issued a statement saying, quote, "We all share a desire to protect the American people, and reviewing our nation's screening and vetting procedures is an appropriate step." Fellow Republican Senator James Lankford agreed with Corker after reviewing the order that heavily restricts travel from six majority Muslim nations and caps the number of refugees the United States will accept.
This is not a Muslim travel ban. It's been very, very clear from the beginning that this is all about countries with unstable governments like Sudan, like Yemen, like Somalia, like Syria, where there's not a functioning government or they're a state sponsor of terrorism like Iran is.
But many Democrats decried the new order just as fiercely as they did Trump's original directive, calling it discriminatory, unnecessary, and counterproductive in the fight against terrorism. Senator Richard Blumenthal summed up the provisions of the executive order this way.
They look a lot like the same old substance cloaked in new dress, modified somewhat, but still potentially raising very serious constitutional issues because of religious tests.
Another Democrat, Senator Patrick Leahy, noted that the United States already subjects travelers from war-torn countries, as well as all refugees, to rigorous screening. He accused the president of implementing policies with no legitimate purpose.
I think that what this may be doing is just trying to find something to justify his campaign pledge to block all Muslims from coming to the country. He should have just said, look, I screwed up. We'll just keep with the regular law.
Democrats say the executive order will tarnish America's image on the world stage. Lankford disagrees.
We have 1 million people a year that come to the United States legally to become citizens. That's not going to change. It's going to be a part of who we are. So we continue to be a place that's welcoming to the world, but we're no different than many other countries. We want a legal process. We want a fair process, but we also want to be able to make sure that we stay secure.
Asked whether the new executive order is an improvement on Trump's original travel directive, Democratic Senator Tom Carper said, quote, "It couldn't have gotten much worse." But Carper is taking a wait-and-see approach. He noted that the new order takes effect in 10 days, meaning that, in theory at least, it could be tweaked and improved if deficiencies are found. Michael Bowman, VOA News, The Capitol.
This is the Voice of America. Time now to check out what's trending on social media with International Edition's G. Abby Lee. She joins me here in the studio with the online buzz. Hey, G.
Hi, Victor. Twitter is filled with reaction to the latest executive order by President Trump. And like you mentioned earlier in the show, he signed a new travel ban with notable differences. For example, it removed Iraq from the list of Muslim-majority countries. The New York Times graphics department shared an image that shows the gist of the executive order, which is that the new immigrants and all refugees are barred, permanent residents are exempted, and diplomats, dual citizens, and Iraqi nationals are allowed.
Well, this, of course, is a temporary ban, but did the president react by tweeting about it?
No, not really, but other politicians took to Twitter. Senator Lindsey Graham tweeted the executive order will help achieve the president's goal of making America safer. Senator Bernie Sanders tweeted the ban isn't about keeping America safe, but rather an anti-Islamic attempt to divide up the country.
Well, while we're on the topic of immigration, the new Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Ben Carson, is in the hot seat for referring to slaves as immigrants. What's the social media reaction to that?
As you can imagine, not many positive responses, especially from the African-American community. He was speaking to his staff on Monday, and many people are pointing out the inaccurate account of history and express deep disappointment. American actor and civil rights activist Samuel L. Jackson is one of the well-known celebrities who responded to the comment on Twitter.
Well, we know there's a lot of other things developing on social media. What else have you got?
Yeah, Canadian pop star Justin Bieber went for a jog in Australia, and of course, that made headlines. The local TV channel in Perth went up to him and asked for a quick chat, and Bieber is in Perth for a concert. The online community seems pleasantly surprised that Bieber was friendly and down to earth. Back to you, Victor.
Well, thank you, G, for that wrap-up. You can find her on Twitter at GAbbyLee. That's Abby with an E, and also on Facebook.com/GAbbyLee.
I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listener's mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on the Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Here now, some of our top stories. President Trump revises an executive order temporarily restricting some people from six countries. North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un personally supervises its latest missile launches. The U.S. deploys troops to Syria as a buffer to keep other forces apart. And a new report says children in Syria suffer from toxic stress, a severe form of psychological trauma. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on the VOANews.com website, as well as our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The North Korean state-run news agency said leader Kim Jong-un personally supervised the launching of four missiles Monday, three of which fell close to Japan. The latest missile launches have been widely condemned and could be the subject of another UN Security Council meeting. The launches occurred during annual joint South Korean-U.S. military exercises. Korea Economic Institute analyst Troy Stangerone reacted to the news that North's intention in launching the missiles was a training exercise targeting U.S. bases in Japan.
They're becoming more bold and more explicit under Kim Jong-un. One of the things that they had said when he shortly took power and they conducted his first nuclear test was that Tokyo would actually be the first target of a nuclear strike by North Korea. So while they haven't made much discussion beyond that of their intent to strike both South Korea and Japan, I think this is a clear sign that should there be any conflict, that Japan would be as much of a target as South Korea would.
Japan has put itself on the highest alert.
And I think that's sensible. These missiles fell very close to, if not within, Japan's exclusive economic zone. This is a threat to Japan's territory, and it's not surprising that they would be on the highest alert, especially given that the exercise is going on. North Korea could conduct further tests.
Troy, South Korea said the missiles North Korea fired Monday were unlikely to have been intercontinental ballistic missiles, or ICBMs, which can reach the United States. They flew at an average of 1,000 kilometers at an altitude of about 260 kilometers. Are these the no-dong medium-range missiles instead?
It's a likely possibility, especially if this was a training exercise for Japan. Those are the types of missiles, various medium-range ballistic missiles that you'd be utilizing to take and hit a target within Japanese territory.
There's some concern that the Trump administration, grappling with many issues, both domestic and foreign, is preoccupied and is not really focused on North Korea. What likely will be the response from the Trump administration, aside from the usual condemnation?
With the transition to General McMaster's, I think that the NSC is better prepared to take and address these types of issues. There have been various signals, both President Trump's own actual reticence and his desire to not take and heighten the tensions on North Korea that seem to indicate that he does take this seriously. That being said, I think the challenge the administration faces is there are very few good options. You have the potential for additional sanctions, but that, of course, would require going through, if we're talking multilateral, the United Nations and getting Japan and, or sorry, excuse me, China and Russia to agree. They could take an attempt to put additional pressure on China by going after banks and other institutions that help facilitate North Korea's activities. And there's a new UN report out demonstrating how extensive those potential networks are. But that would also potentially undermine the chance for cooperation on China's side. You could also take and begin moving in other defensive measures. President Trump has indicated he'd like to take and engage a significant U.S. military buildup. So you could increase U.S. deterrence. But ultimately, none of those solutions are likely to take and lead to the result you want. And that is the difficulty I think we face.
Troy Stangarone of the Korea Economic Institute. The U.S. U.N. Ambassador Nikki Haley tweeted Monday, "The world will not allow the North to continue on its destructive path." This is the Voice of America. The U.S. Defense Department said Monday it's deploying a small number of troops to northern Syria in and around the recently liberated town of Manbij as a way to keep rival fighters from attacking each other. Since U.S.-backed Kurdish forces freed the town of Islamic State militants, Turkish-backed rebels and Russian-backed government forces have been moving closer to Manbij. The Pentagon said the U.S. troops are there as a visible sign of deterrence and reassurance to deter fresh fighting and reassure the IS menace is gone. Stephen Zunis, regional analyst at the University of San Francisco, spoke to me earlier about the deployment.
The goal is quite reasonable, given the very real threat from the Islamic State. Obviously, the United States and other countries as well have an interest in trying to get the forces on the ground to focus on them instead of fighting each other. At the same time, there's always a risk with U.S. forces on the ground that they could become just another faction and be drawn into the fighting themselves.
Well, these forces, the Turkish-backed rebels, the U.S.-backed Kurdish rebels, as well as Syrian forces backed by Russia, are converging, and they're close to this city of Manbij, or town of Manbij. What can you tell us about this? How strategic is it?
Well, it's been an area that ISIS had controlled and was liberated by the Syrian Democratic Forces, which is a group consisting both Arab and Kurdish fighters, much of it with support of the YPG, a Kurdish group that has been successful in fighting ISIS and liberating territories in northern Iraq. In many respects, they have been man for man, or I should say, or person for person, because they do include a fair number of women fighters, unlike most groups in that conflict. They've been a very effective group because they, unlike almost any of the other factions, and unlike the Syrian government, they do tend to have a popular base. They do have support of the population, and they've been able to mobilize, have well-motivated fighters, and as a result have been able to gain ground and hold it to a degree which is unusual in this back-and-forth kind of civil war. What disturbs the Turks is that the YPG, which makes up the bulk of the Syrian Democratic Forces, is very closely allied with the PKK, the armed Kurdish group that's been struggling for greater autonomy from Turkey for quite a few years, which Turkey considers to be a terrorist group. And so Turkey, along with some Islamist Syrian allies, have been advancing on the city as well. And the United States is concerned that they'll focus on fighting the SDF forces instead of ISIS.
Stephen Zunis of the University of San Francisco. The volatile situation in and around Manbij is of concern to U.S. officials who want to keep the focus on capturing the IS-held Syrian city of Raqqa. The U.S. wants to keep Kurdish militia in the vanguard of that offensive, something Turkey finds objectionable. This is VOA's International Edition. Well, Ed Sheeran, one of the biggest pop stars today, has a new album out with two songs already high on the charts. VOA Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald tells VOA's Jim Stevenson what Ed Sheeran has been doing after taking a year off, mostly from social media.
One of the great rags-to-riches stories of modern music. Ed was homeless. He was a vagabond for a while he was coming up. He'd sleep on friends' couches, slept outside a few times, and now he's one of the biggest music stars on earth.
Isn't that where you would get your best material from, though?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And he said that. He says, life has given me a lot of great material. His new album's called Divide. It comes 2 years and 9 months after his second set, Multiply, which Spotify named as the most streamed album in the world in 2014. So anticipation was high for this. Now, in December of 2015, Ed announced a hiatus from social media. He says, I'm turning all of this off. I'm going underground. Exactly 1 year later, he was back on social media with the cover design for the Divide album. It features songwriting collaborations with Ryan Tedder, who's the leader of the band One Republic, and a hit songwriter in his own right. Ed also collaborated with British singer Jesse Ware, and he co-produced his hit single Castle on the Hill with Benny Blanco, who's worked with Justin Bieber, Maroon 5, Katy Perry, a bunch of other huge stars. But this is not an album filled with guest stars. This is truly an Ed Sheeran album. He released two singles at the same time prior to the album, Castle on the Hill and Shape of You. They both immediately went to the top two slots on the UK singles chart, first time that ever happened in British chart history. Shape of You also debuted at number one here in America on the Hot 100, and it's there right now. It's logged five total weeks at the top. And last year, Ed also hit number one with the song Love Yourself, which he wrote and gave to Justin Bieber. He said it just wouldn't fit on Divide. So he let Justin sing it, and it was a number one hit. That's not all Ed Sheeran gave Justin Bieber. He also gave him a shot to the head with a golf club. And like many of Ed Sheeran's stories, it starts out with, we got drunk one night, mm-hmm. because Ed is a bit of a party animal. Now, apparently, he and Justin went to a bar, and then they ended up at a golf course. And Justin Bieber put a golf ball in his mouth and said, Ed, hit the golf ball out of my mouth.
Oh.
Well, as you can imagine, it didn't go quite as planned. Ed had a couple of other adventures in 2016. He got cut on his cheek by a sword wielded by a member of the British royal family. They were horsing around, and she wanted to knight him. And then Ed also required ear surgery after he jumped off a yacht and burst his eardrum.
The price of stardom.
The price of stardom. This is a guy, he just turned 26. He wants to live life to the fullest, and he has every opportunity to.
We look forward to catching one of his shows and one of his songs on the Top 20 Countdown, hosted by our own Ray McDonald.
There's a lot of Ed Sheeran in the countdown right now.
And you can also catch Ray on Twitter.
At Ray on the Hits.
Thanks so much, Ray.
You got it, Jim.
Come on, baby. I'm in love with your body. Come on, be my baby. With your body, every day discovering something brand new. I'm in love with the shape of you.
This is Science in a Minute.
Researchers at the University of California, San Diego, say they have developed a new blood test that can spot not only the presence of cancer, but also help doctors pinpoint where in the body the cancer tumor is growing. According to a study which details the researchers' findings, this new blood test could very well offer a new, non-invasive way to diagnose cancer patients. Currently, doctors rely on methods including surgical techniques such as biopsies to diagnose cancer. Scientists say that when cancer cells invade a part of the body, they compete with and begin to kill off the normal cells in the area for both nutrients and space. The new test works by not only detecting a unique DNA signature from the cancer cells in the bloodstream themselves, but the DNA that's cast off from the normal cells killed by the tumor cells. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Thank you, Rick. Crowds gathered in frigid temperatures in Fairbanks, Alaska early Monday to cheer as more than 70 mushers set off on a nearly 1,600-kilometer trek across the wilderness for the second time in 3 years. The race began in Fairbanks, which is farther north of Anchorage. Due to inadequate snow, Alaska experienced record warmth last year, logging the warmest May the state has seen in the past 137 years. You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Like us on Facebook, VOA Now. Follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Thanks again for joining us. The director, Tracy Carter. The engineer, Chaz Hall. I'm Victor Beatty in Washington. You're listening to The Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is working with its partner, Rwanda, to help children read. On February 16th, the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, held a launch event at Groupe Scolaire Kinyinya to highlight the U.S. government's early grade reading project, which aims to improve the Kinyarwanda reading skills of 1 million children over the next 4 years. The Early Grade Reading Project is implemented in partnership with the Ministry of Education and the Rwanda Education Board, and it consists of three activities that are valued at over 68 billion Rwandan francs, or about 80 million U.S. dollars. The U.S. government's partnership to support Kinyarwanda literacy is built upon evidence that literacy in the first language that students speak and understand is foundational for their success in school. The Early Grade Reading Project's three complementary activities are the Mureke Dusam Let's Read activity engages parents, communities, and literacy champions to help children embrace a culture of reading outside of school. Mureke Dusam is implemented by Save the Children in collaboration with the Rwandan Education Board. The Soma Umenye Read and Know activity will train teachers and provide extra reading materials to schools. It will also strengthen the capacity of the Rwanda Education Board and advocate for policies that support reading. And the Teacher Mentorship Community of Practice program, implemented by FHI 360, U.S.-based public health and international development NGO, has developed an online platform for teachers to access teaching materials and forums and to take teaching certification courses online. U.S. Ambassador to Rwanda, Erica Barks Ruggles, highlighted the importance of partnership with the Ministry of Education and civil society. Also on hand for the launch were Rwanda's Minister of State, in charge of primary and secondary education, and the Director General of the Rwanda Education Board. The three worked with parents from Gikumbi District to create homemade reading materials for children. Our partnership with the government of Rwanda, teachers, community leaders, and parents is key to achieving Rwanda's literacy goals as set out in Vision 2020, said Ambassador Barks Ruggles. We are working with all our partners to support children's reading ability so that every child has the opportunity to succeed and help build Rwanda's future.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.